You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is environmental activist and adventurer Marcus Erickson. As co-founder and director of research for the Five Gyrus Institute, he's embarked on a number of ocean crossing expeditions, studying and building awareness about the extent of plastics pollution in our oceans. You've probably heard of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Well, actually, that patch is one of five around the world. Erickson has spent the last 10 years conducting research on the extent and effect of this garbage, especially plastic garbage, on marine ecosystems. Erickson has rafted down the Mississippi River on a raft made of recycled plastic bottles, which was recounted in his book, My River Home, and his latest book, Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution, recounts his 88-day voyage through the Pacific Trash Gyre on a raft made of recycled 2-liter bottles, spare ship, and airplane parts. But he also tells the story of the growing activism against waterborne plastics pollution. Erickson's Five Gyrus Institute has taken the lead in advocating changes in our behavior as well as convincing the plastics industry to make their products more recyclable and increase the percentage of truly recyclable packaging. He joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Marcus Erickson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, Junk Raft, details an ocean voyage and your work in activism against plastics pollution. How did that interest begin?
Well, it began more as a scientific interest. You know, more than 10 years ago, what I noticed was some conversation about these islands of trash in the Pacific Ocean between Hawaii and California. And what I understood, knowing about ocean currents, there are five big accumulation zones in the world. And that interest drove me to form the Five Gyrus Institute with my wife and began, it's now been 20 expeditions surveying plastics in the world's oceans.
In the book, you talk about one of your first trips. I assume it might have been one of your first trips, and it was to Midway Island. What is important about Midway Island?
Well, it was interesting. You know, back then, that goes back almost 17 years now, I was a high school teacher, science teacher, and I, with a few other teachers, we led a group of 14 students to Hawaii, and then from Waikiki, it's another 800 miles to almost one of the last islands called Midway. And Midway, I mean, it's amazing for its World War II history. All the infrastructure is still there, if you know about the Battle of Midway.
Right.
And we were there, but it's also the home to about 5,000 mating pairs of lace-sun albatross. An albatross is a bird that's bigger than a goose, these massive, beautiful birds, and they nest there. And we're looking at the bird ecology, looking at American history, and I can tell you every single dead bird that I saw, and it's normal to have a few carcasses lying around, hundreds of them. Every single one I saw had a little handful, like a fistful-sized mound of plastic trash inside the rib cage.
Wow.
And I realized that these birds are so far from the mainland, U.S. and China and Japan and Mexico. They're in the middle of the Pacific, and they're eating our trash and dying because of it. And it hit me to my moral core that, okay, something's not working in this process of using plastic. And that was one of the actually beginning moments for me, was realizing we had a problem that we had to fix.
And you recount in the book about talking to marine biologists there, and they were saying that every bird they found had plastics in their stomach, they were swallowing fishing line, and more importantly, they were feeding it to their young.
Yeah, every single one we saw. And there's video footage of these albatross, these adults. And, if you're a parent, you can empathize with other living things that try to feed their young. You watch these adults. They'll go off for up to a whole week to be on the ocean, flying. Even while they're sleeping, they can fly. And they'll fill their belly full of food, squid and fish, and unfortunately plastic. And they'll come back to Midway, tired as could be, and they just want to feed their young. They find their nest. They regurgitate a stomach full of plastic trash into their young chick, and the chick suffers, and the chick becomes malnourished and dies in front of the parent's eyes. And that, that also struck me as this doesn't sit well with me. We as a civilization can do much better. And that kind of sparked again, that sort of moral core that says, okay, there's a wrong in the world, let's find ways to fix it.
And Midway is probably the closest landmass to that gyre in the North Pacific, isn't it?
It's almost smack in the middle of it.
So the beaches were covered with plastic?
It was unreal to see the windward-facing side, where the wind and waves are crashing. You see more plastic than sand in some places. There's so much trash. And it's the usual things you might see on a dirty curbside in any city in the United States. Even there in Tulsa, you might see, you know, a plastic straw, a couplet, a bottle cap, a bottle. You might see those things, you know, on an empty field. The same things on Midway. But also in Midway, there's fishing gear, there's fishing buoys, fishing line, but a lot of consumer stuff, consumer products. And that's a point where we can interject and do something different.
Yeah. Now, as you began learning about this, you actually went to one of the first researchers that started talking about plastics pollution. He was publishing papers back in the, I guess it was 1970s. And yeah. What you found was this guy was like immediately attacked by the plastics industry, saying his research was not relevant. It was unscientific. They basically tried to blackball him, it sounded like.
Yes, and that's what's interesting. Think of the 1970s, early 1970s, in the United States. The environmental movement had been growing really rapidly, and the industries that make plastic were seeing some plastic pollution issues really rising fast. And the response was, you know, typical of many industries, attack the scientists that are raising the red flag. And they did that to this guy, Edwin Carpenter. He was a researcher out of Woods Hole on the East Coast, doing work in the Atlantic. He was studying plankton, and his nets were full of like little rice grain-sized fragments of plastic. And he wrote a research paper saying, hey, I'm finding all this plastic in all of my plankton toes. And immediately, within a few months, he had industry at his doorstep saying, you know, you're un-American. Why are you attacking an American industry? You're killing jobs and all this nonsense. And he also spoke to supervisors. And a year later, even after he had published 13 more research papers, which is a lot for a brand-new scientist, in that year, he got fired. Hmm. And I met him. He teaches now here in California, and he remembers clear as day, you know, that time almost 40 years ago, seeing the rise of the plastic pollution issue, seeing, I don't know if you remember on TV, the Crying Indian campaigns. You would
right.
see a Native American on TV shedding a tear when a plastic bag goes by.
Yeah.
Industry funded those commercials, and the tagline on those commercials were, people cause pollution, which is completely, I think, putting the onus on just the public and not the design of products. Industry has been very good at washing their hands of responsibility for making products that are truly recyclable. They'll say out of one corner of their mouth, people must be responsible to recycle, but then avoid any responsibility and fight responsibility to make things truly recyclable. And that's been the heart, I think, of the problem of ending this throwaway plastic culture that we live in.
Now, your book, Junk Raft, details an ocean voyage from California to Hawaii on a raft made of plastic soda bottles and airplane parts. And apparently this is something you've been doing for a while. You went down the Mississippi in another similar raft years before. I guess you've been doing it over time. What was the impetus for doing these voyages? Is it just to bring visibility to plastic pollution?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first started, so I grew up in the deep south, Louisiana, just outside New Orleans. And I, like many kids, and if you grew up in rural United States, you have a often a personal connection to nature because you experience it. I spent so much time, you know, hunting and fishing. I had dreamed, like many kids, to raft the Mississippi River. And you know, there's a little backstory here. When I finished high school, I joined the Marines. And I spent 6 years in the Marine Corps, and I found myself in 1991 sitting in a foxhole in Kuwait. Hmm. This is back when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. And before Saddam Hussein left, he set all the oil fields on fire. You remember those images of the
right.
Gulf War? So I was one of the Marines. I was in an infantry unit, and I was in a foxhole, covered in drops of oil, looking around at this Armageddon around me. And I remember saying to a buddy, if I survive this, I'm going to raft the Mississippi River. And it took me 13 years in 2003 to make good on that promise. I couldn't find that Marine I was in the foxhole with. I was going to invite him. But I built a raft, and I took a 232 2-liter pop bottles, and I built a raft. At that time, I figured, you know, plastic bottles, they're unsinkable. If you want to sink a plastic bottle raft, you got to pop every bottle. So I made this raft. I had a friend in the van drop me off in Lake Itasca, Minnesota, and it took me 5 months to raft near 2,300 miles right to the heartland of America, to the Gulf of Mexico. And I can tell you, as a veteran, it rekindled my love of nature and my connection to American people. I had people just take care of me on the river. When I was cold, when I was tired, when I was hungry, people would just feed me, clothe me, give me a place to stay. I had one couple in, in Arkansas, that I showed up on the loading dock in the bank of the river, pulled my raft out of the water, set up camp, and these people saw me, and I was just there alone camping. They came back 2 hours later with a full plate of Thanksgiving dinner for me.
Wow.
And just gave it to me. And it's interesting, that experience, you know, rekindling my love of our country, the people in the land, and the river, and then seeing trash, I could always see a plastic bottle or a bag or a bottle cap or a straw or a couplet, all this single-use throwaway plastic stuff going down our river out to sea. That struck me as just deeply wrong. I didn't want to see us doing that. There's a design flaw in those products. So if you add that to that experience on Midway, seeing animals eating our trash, seeing the trash coming from my river, our river, being in the Gulf War, think about what's worth fighting for. It was a no-brainer for me. I've got to see a change in this plastic pollution issue.
In Junkraft, you recount this ocean voyage from California to Hawaii. Again, I guess you had a sail set up and you were becalmed on the journey. Had no families to help you out. It was fishing and surviving by your wits. But in the course of going through the ocean to Hawaii and going to the gyre, what do you see when you see out there? Because, you know, the press reports are of this sort of Texas-sized plastic island, and it's really not an island. It's just tons of plastic in the water everywhere.
Yes, there's a need for a big reality check. You know, as a scientist, beginning as a science teacher, now becoming an environmental scientist, studying these issues, I think you've got to do good science so you get a good grasp on reality. There is no island of trash out there, and I've sailed through it. I've gone to the North Pacific now 5 times, Hawaii to California and back, on research vessels and on this raft, the junk raft. And that junk raft, that's the core of this book, Junk Raft, is 15,000 plastic bottles. We took 24 old broken sailboat masts, made a deck, and then for a cabin, we took a Cessna 310 aircraft and tied it to the whole thing, had a piece of sail, and we set off for Hawaii, right through this mythical garbage patch. I can tell you the island of trash isn't there, but what's there is worse. In my opinion, much, much worse. If it were an island of trash, I'd be the first on the ship to go get it. To go get it, grab it, capture it, and deal with it. What you've got, you know, you're out there, you don't see much. You might see a fishing buoy float by, some old fishing net, a bottle cap, maybe a straw or a fork or a spoon goes by. When you drag a net, and I've done this now around the world, thousands of times, when you drag a net, on the end of our net is like a little sock with a real fine, fine mesh, like a spaghetti strainer, but smaller. You pick it up, and you've got like this handful of plastic dust, from dust-sized particles to rice grain-sized particles, this multicolored confetti of plastic. And you realize what you're looking at is not an island, but more like underwater clouds, like a smog.
Silt, maybe. A silt.
Permeates the oceans.
Yeah.
And that's reality. And that's much more bioavailable to marine life. Marine life aren't going to eat. A fish is not going to eat a big buoy. But the fish can consume, you know, small particles by the trillions that are floating in our oceans.
Just in the normal habit of a marine bird eating a fish and taking in water, they're taking in tons of lots of little microparticles of plastic.
Yes, and I followed the research on this, and there have now been well over 1,200 species identified that are eating our trash. There are so many filter feeding organisms that are out there. I mean, much of the ocean is full of filter feeders that open their mouth, they grab some water, and they eat what they catch. Now they're grabbing plastic. And for example, there are small fish called myctophids. The myctophid fish are perhaps the most abundant fish in the oceans. They're eating trash more than any other. And it makes them very buoyant because plastic floats. And these fish live like more than 1,000 feet below the ocean surface. They'll come up at night to feed. They're coming up at night to feed. They're just grabbing what they see, which used to be just food. Now they're grabbing plastic on accident, eating it, and they can't get down. Or when they try to get down deep, they expend tons of energy trying to get down with this very buoyant material in their stomach. It's like as if you had swallowed, 10 styrofoam cups and you're trying to get to the bottom of the pool. It gets more difficult and you lose energy. So we're seeing these impacts are broad, they're widespread across the oceans, and I think we're playing with fire. You've got the entire ocean biosphere being impacted by this global loss of trash from land to sea. And I think the prognosis isn't good for the future if we don't do something about it.
My guest today is Marcus Erickson. He's the Five Gyros Institute co-founder and research director and author of Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. That's the name of his new book. Earlier, you said it's really incumbent on the plastics industry to change their products. Are we seeing any sign that some plastic manufacturers are changing their designs to make them more recyclable, to make them less disposable?
Unfortunately, very few. And that's where I think the United States has an opportunity to really take some responsibility, not responsibility, but also leadership in this role. You're seeing other countries do it. You're seeing other countries say, okay, plastic bags, they're by design, they fly out of garbage cans, out of trucks, out of the landfills, they get stuck in fences. Cows, cattle, horses are eating them. And I have found, big wads of plastic bags and camel stomachs in Dubai when I went back there. So I think you're seeing some companies in other countries are responding by saying, okay, let's reinvent this so that it is truly recyclable. But I think those efforts are hard won here in the U.S. But we're seeing some companies that do it. For example, Lush Cosmetics. They were using small plastic microbeads, like little plastic, little dust, in their facial scrubs as an abrasive. When they found out that those facial scrubs, those little microbeads, were polluting the Great Lakes, and that's based on a paper that we published, they stopped. They said, okay, this doesn't work, this doesn't fit our company's values, and they stopped putting plastic as an abrasive and chose something like cocoa beans, sand, or apricot husks.
Mm-hmm.
But companies like Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson, it took the Microbead Free Waters Act, federal law, to get them to stop putting microbeads in their products. So I wish it didn't have to go to policy, but I think that's what has to happen to level the playing field so we all play by the same rules. Rules that are beneficial to us and the environment. Changes are happening, but they're slow.
What countries are taking the lead in fighting plastic pollution, and what sort of steps are they taking?
Well, we're seeing, for example, in Rwanda, of all places, they ban plastic bags. If you go to Rwanda, they search your luggage, find a plastic bag, they'll take it out. In Europe, many countries were some of the first to ban microbeads and products. Countries like Chile. In Chile, they have an EPR bill. That's an extended producer responsibility. And by law, a company that makes a product, they're responsible to get that product back to their factory as a post-consumer waste. If you make a plastic bottle, you got to get half of your branded bottles or more back to your factory. And what that's doing is it's causing those companies to think about, okay, what is a good system to get our product back? What's a good system that when we get our product back, we can really reuse it and make a new product? So those EPR bills are forcing manufacturers to think about recycling by design. I think in the U.S., if we had that standard and make it across the board, like level the playing field with some policy that says, if we're going to talk about recycling, you've got to make everything recyclable in a way that makes sense. Because I can tell you in the United States right now, big cities to small towns are having to pay a lot for waste management. As a taxpayer, I'm tired of paying taxes to clean up a mess of products and packaging that are on our roadsides, stuck in fences, stuck in trees, clogging storm drains, because these products have no recycle value. They have no value. So I think if we're able to level the playing field with some good policies that say, make the stuff really recyclable, or if you can't, then go to something that's more benign. Paper's going to disappear in the environment. Glass isn't going to do the kind of harm that plastic does. So I think if we can do that, I think you will see less trash going down America's rivers. And that's the goal we have.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned glass and a paper. We think of those as something we should not use for, you know, just because of the recycling value. Are those better products?
I would say that they have their own life cycle costs.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest above those to bring your own if you can. And most people do. I mean, if you think the wisdom of our grandparents. My best friend's grandmother still has a cart that she brings to the store, her own bags. Been doing it for decades. So I think bringing your own bags, your own containers, you're seeing more and more stores like co-ops. And if you want a laundry detergent, you can go and buy the detergent by the pound without the packaging. Bring your own packaging. We're seeing folks bring their own bottles, their own bags of groceries, own coffee mugs. So you're seeing the responsibility happen without needing to use paper or plastic either. Often what I suggest to people, to individuals, is to look at your grocery list and think in terms of you're not just buying the product, you're also buying the packaging. And that makes me think, like when I go buy my groceries, I think, okay, I want peanut butter, but do I need my peanut butter in a plastic jar that I know is going to end up going to a landfill, an incinerator, or to some kid's hands in China? Instead, how about if I bring my own container? I've seen many stores that you can make peanut butter on site, open a peanut butter machine. So I think if you think in terms of the packaging and reducing the packaging, and just focus on just getting the product, there are a lot of companies out there that are finding innovative ways to deliver those products to customers without this glut of packaging.
My guest today is Marcus Erickson. He is the author of Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. It's about his voyage from California to Hawaii in 2008 on a recycled raft made of plastic soda bottles, airplane parts, and recycled ship parts. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He is the co-founder and research director of the Five Gyros Institute. One of the things I was interesting about Five Gyros is you're doing your own work in finding ways to reduce the amount of plastic that's just going into our garbage. Things like innovative little small solar kilns that create plastic bricks. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, that was after, you know, years of research, you know, visiting some really remote places on the planet, and seeing that, you know, plastic is often on a one-way trajectory from being produced, production, manufacture, consumption. We buy it, and then in really, really remote places, on islands or small communities, it goes right to a landfill or incinerator because recycle value isn't there for a lot of it. So waste haulers don't bundle plastic bags, for example, and do much with it. One idea we had was, instead of burning the stuff, why not create a system of local remanufacture? And I think there's a lot of thought in the world trending towards local circular economies, where we try to make and consume, produce everything within a very short distance of where we live. Like in Tulsa, imagine if you could make your own power, make your own products, have your own systems of recycling where you can remanufacture right then and there. And the plastic brick is that kind of idea, where if we had, imagine if you had a bunch of broken buckets, broken crates, and you had a system where those products could be shredded and those plastics put into a mold and using either your own electric grid or a bunch of solar panels, melt that plastic into a functional brick. We've done this already. So we did this in Bermuda. We did it in the Bahamas on a small island. So working with a couple engineers, this one engineer I met here in California that builds solar arrays for satellites, love the idea. We took our 4 solar panels, a little oven, and we made it, and it works.
That's amazing.
So it's an option to avoid communities burning trash, instead remanufacture locally.
I want to ask you about one other element. Your organization, Five Gyros, talks about how people and companies need to make changes in making a change in plastics pollution. As you are well aware of, the Ocean Cleanup Array, Boyan Slat is talking about cleaning up those gyros. Do you think that's feasible at all?
I don't, honestly. I would much prefer to see his work go upstream. If you think of the science of ocean currents and where the trash is coming from, it's mostly coming from big rivers around the world. There have been a couple papers published showing which rivers are the most polluting. If you're going to build a net, put it there. Because I can tell you, once plastic leaves a big river, all the single-use throwaway packaging, the thin plastic bags, the thin film, the straws and cup lids, it begins to fragment very quickly. Fish are tearing it apart. Sunlight is making it brittle. And it gets crushed and becomes small particles. If you put a big net in the middle of the ocean, you're going to get mostly fishing gear. So I think putting a big net, or even a bunch of smaller nets in the middle of the ocean, you're not going to curb the harm that's happening from the products that are initially leaving shore. But that kind of work is kind of already being done. There are a lot of companies already putting these nets at rivers. And one I would point out is called the trash wheel. In Baltimore, for example, they put a trash wheel. It is like a water wheel, solar powered, that has a big giant floating V of booms that direct the trash down the river to this water wheel, and it lifts it and puts it into a big floating dumpster. And without even touching it, almost autonomous, I talked to the owners, and in one summer, they collected 300 tons of trash.
Wow.
And this company is now exporting these. They're so busy putting these in rivers across the United States. So I think river capture is where it's at. In the middle of the ocean, what's happened to the trash that's out there now, the oceans were really dynamic. If we could stop the flow of trash and land to see our rivers, I would guess in 10 to 20 years max, you would see the majority of the trash leave the ocean, wash ashore. Islands are the natural nets already capturing trash. What's fragmented is going to sink, and the ocean will clean itself. The ocean is really a dynamic system that cleans itself, so we can stop the flow of trash from land to sea.
The name of the book is Junk Raft, which talks about the voyage as well as the work done on fighting plastic pollution. Marcus Erickson, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Environmental activist and adventurer Marcus Erickson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His book about his voyage across the Pacific is titled Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. It's published by Beacon Press. If you'd like more information about his organization, Five Gyros Institute, you can visit their website at thenumber5gyros.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.